Hi, everyone. I wanted to start out today with a quick shout out to Matron Saint, a super chic maternity line that wants to revolutionize the way you dress as you embark on motherhood. Their clothes are simple, stylish, and comfortable. Use the code PYC20 when you check out for 20% off your order. Now I want to ask you, my listeners, for a shout out. Rate and review Yoga Birth Babies on iTunes or Stitcher, and follow PYC and Matron Saint on Instagram for your chance to win a $100 gift card from Matron Saint. Email a screenshot of your review and your handle to info@prenatalyogacenter.com. Thanks for listening. Hi, everyone. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Welcome to Yoga, Birth, Babies, a podcast produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. We will be diving into everything prenatal yoga, birth, and baby-related, hoping to inspire, educate, and empower you through your journey into motherhood. Thank you for listening. For my yoga teacher friends who are interested in working with the pregnant population, Prenatal Yoga Center offers an 85-hour Yoga Alliance certified program based on our three-pronged theory of prenatal yoga: asana, education, and community. Once a year, we hold our three-month immersion program in New York City. For those who cannot attend this training, Caprice and I are now traveling to different locations holding our training at hosting studios where we will spend 6 days working together, exploring and learning about prenatal yoga. This training consists of more than 50 hours working together. We also created a whole membership website with more than 20 videos corresponding directly to the manual you will receive. For more information, check out our website at prenatalyogacenter.com. Hope to work with you soon. Take care. Hi, everyone. I'm Deb Flaschenberg, and I am your host for Yoga Birth Babies. And today we're speaking with Kimberly Seals Allers, and she is the author of The Big Letdown: How Medicine, Big Business, and Feminism Undermines Breastfeeding. Let me tell you a little bit about Kimberly. Kimberly Seals Allers is an award-winning journalist and leading breastfeeding commentator. Her work has been featured in The New York Times, Huffington Post, The Daily Beast, CNN, Ladies Home Journal, and many others. Kimberly worked at Fortune, Essence, New York Post, and The Times of London before turning to freelance work. She's the author of the Mocha series of books and co-author of Giving Notice, Why the Best and Brightest Are Leaving the Workplace, and of course, The Big Letdown: How Medicine, Big Business, and Feminism Undermine Breastfeeding. Hi, Kimberly. Thank you so much for being on my podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Oh, I know. We've tried to connect, so connecting and talking about your book really excites me. So let's just jump into, I read your book. I loved it. And what inspired you to write this?
Well, I was really inspired by, one, my own experiences. You know, you may recall I start the book with my own challenges and kind of feeling like I had done everything right, quote unquote, and then facing this extreme disappointment and challenge and frustration. But also because, you know, through my own experiences, I began to see so many women who were so successful in many areas of their life, but really found that, you know, lactation was one area where they doubted themselves or they felt like they couldn't do it. And it was just a strange thing around something that is technically our biological norm. And the fact that so many women were having struggles with something that we are told is natural, to me, was a cause for concern and also a point of inquiry, right? So I come to this work really as a journalist, thinking about issues and, you know, in a way that asks questions. So I really wanted to kind of think about why this was happening and what are the issues. And obviously, coupled with that, I was frustrated by seeing what we all see, which are so-called mommy wars and people kind of battling it out, and really wanted to look up at the real barriers that are out there. You know, who are the real culprits behind why women are struggling with something that is, one, our biological norm, and two, a very important part of motherhood. You know, we start as parents, our first job is to feed our children, and to have challenges or struggles or to feel like you're failing around something like that is very, you know, it's hard, and it kind of shapes your experience from the early days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the picture you paint when I was reading your book about driving as fast as you could, get into the hospital, the doors locked, and then just like leaning against the door, dripping milk, wondering why isn't anyone helping me? I think, well, someone may not have actually gone to the hospital searching support. I think all women that have tried breastfeeding can relate to, I need help. I don't have the help. Can someone please help me? So I thought it was very relatable and right from the beginning.
Yeah, thank you. And then the idea that the people that you think should be able to help you usually can't. And so we just don't know where to go. I mean, that's part of the other part of the big letdown is just, you know, you may turn to your physician, but they may not have much lactation training. And, you know, many women, because of economics, whether that is your job or your husband's job or whatever, you're not as close to your mom of that kind of traditional support circle and that traditional knowledge that was passed on, you know, through women. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, all these things have kind of come together to create a really difficult situation for a lot of women. And, you know, that really shouldn't be the case.
Absolutely. So what were some of the most surprising facts or experiences that you came across while researching and writing your book?
Well, I think as much as I know this kind of, you know, intuitively, I was really shocked to kind of dig into the infant formula companies, how much money they make. You know, really, you know, I was a business journalist for many years. So kind of bringing in that sensitivity to and that sensibility to the project was interesting for me. But really just looking at, you know, how deep it goes in terms of their marketing dollars, looking at how, you know, they really talk about, even in their very open analyst phone calls, about the business of infant feeding. And, you know, and many women think that their goal is about infant nutrition, but their goal is really to increase revenue. And so it was really sobering realities and really digging into what really drives these, you know, these products. And it is really all about making more money.
Yeah, I actually was disturbed to learn that the pharmaceutical companies offered things like free stuff to the doctors and nurses and funded studies to support their products. So what, you know, not knowing the background of pharmaceutical companies are the ones putting out the infant formula, can you talk a little bit about what you discovered, how they're the drivers in this?
Yeah, I mean, basically, there are two key areas that, you know, I talked about in the book, one being with the infant formula companies themselves and, you know, their role historically in kind of cozying up to physicians, paying for physician trips, paying for conferences, the so-called ski and learn experiences. And then there's the idea that Big Pharma has a big interest in this because basically they have the power to shape our health, right? And so if I have a less healthy diet as an infant, I am more likely to have a diet-related disease or some other condition that will require me to use their drugs in the future. So really, it is part of the setup, also the letdown, that, you know, Big Pharma has an interest in us being sick, you know, and where's the best place to start at investing in that goal, which is at birth. And so we see this big battle that goes on around the first food. We see this kind of fighting around how do you get to be every newborn's first meal and then therefore, one, hook them on something once you have suppressed the biological norm, and then two, set them up for the likelihood of being less healthy, which would increase their likelihood for needing some sort of drug down the line. And so it's really insidious and quite shameful because we're talking about infants, you know, at the beginning of the conversation. And so kind of looking through all those things, the other thing that was very disturbing for me was realizing that, you know, only in the infant nutrition space is it acceptable for the people making the substitute product to be responsible for educating the physicians, right? So as I say in the book, nobody would hire a dietitian who was trained at some McDonald's Nutrition Institute, right? That would be silly. But we go to physicians who have literally only had any significant training by the so-called infant formula companies and the quote-unquote institutes that they've created. And the fact that this only happens in the thing that women uniquely do is something that I think should concern all women. And that's why, for me, this is not just about breastfeeding, but about women and our rights and our bodies and who's controlling that.
You also made some interesting points, which I had no idea about, the relationship between growth charts and infant formula. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. I mean, I hope people will still read the book. Okay. I don't want to give it all away.
Okay, sorry.
but certainly I share the experience of how my daughter was being judged, as many children are, around growth charts that were created by the infant formula companies and based on infant formula fed growth patterns. And breastfed children are, they grow differently. They have a different wave of growth. And so, I was one of those mothers who was breastfeeding and was told that I need to supplement because my baby did not meet the, you know, was not meeting the growth chart. But no one ever said that that growth chart was A, kind of based on formula fed babies, and two, you know, had been paid for and created by the infant formula companies. And so that seeing those ubiquitous infant formula logos on growth charts was a, you know, pediatric staple for decades. And it took many years for there to be an actual growth chart that was based on breastfed babies, that at least including them in the sample.
So charts that someone's having a baby right now, and they're heading to their pediatrician, they're getting the baby weighed and measured. Are the charts they're using now new and they're not being put out by the infant formula companies?
You should definitely ask. I mean, I've still seen them, and many doctors, you know, still use them. So everyone should be asking for the WHO growth charts to be used for measuring their baby.
So when you realized that for your own child, was it like a light bulb moment and you were asking, don't hold my child to these same standards? Or how did you, from your own personal experience, navigate that?
Well, I didn't know. I mean, these are things that I discovered later. I just ignored the doctor because I felt like, you know, she was growing, and I didn't allow that time to undermine my breastfeeding at that time, but it did worry me. I mean, it definitely planted a seed of doubt. And I remember, you know, that I did not throw away the formula that was given to me. And that was probably a reason why, even though I did not use it at that time. And so, again, it was a matter of planting doubt and really, you know, kind of making me afraid of something that there was no real reason for me to be worried about. And so these are the things that we are looking at in terms of the places that women deserve better. And instead of us being supported and being confident about our body's ability to feed our children, whether that is to birth our children or feed our children, we're constantly being undermined and sold messages that we can't.
Well, let's tap into that, the undermining. So I know there are certain hospitals that are baby friendly, and they are not allowed to give anything infant formula related or infant formula away. So the undermining, that if you were given formula at your doctor's or your hospital, how did you feel that? Did you feel like, okay, if I can't do this, it's there? Do you feel women are being undermined from the very beginning because of the infant formula?
Absolutely. I mean, they give it to you, and then what they say is just in case, right? So that just in case is already planting a seed of doubt in your mind that you may not be able to do it. And so, you know, the whole idea around giving away infant formula, quote unquote, just in case, even to people who don't even ask for it, is a way to try to undermine your confidence. And so all women are being undermined, and what we don't talk about is the fact that we get infant formula in the hospital has nothing to do with our babies or anything. It has everything to do with the fact that that hospital accepted a backdoor multi-million-dollar deal to get money from the infant formula companies for the right to market to you. And we don't even get a cut of the check, right? So whether we want it or not, we are being given things because, you know, a financial transaction was made, not because somebody, an independent, you know, health authority determined this was in the best interest of us or our children. And so these are the things that we have to start talking about. It is perfectly okay to use infant formula if you choose, but these decisions should not be based on commercial interests. We have to get the money out of our bodies, our birth, and our breastfeeding for us to really have informed decision-making and true choice.
Yeah, I was a little floored when I was reading about the marketing to women before they even give birth. Can you talk a little bit more about how that's creating fear even before the baby even comes?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the quotes from the CEO of Mead Johnson was about how he was bragging at an analyst conference, a Wall Street conference, about having 75% of the names and addresses, the names and addresses of 75% of all U.S. women before they give birth. And so this idea, I mean, obviously, when you're pregnant, it's a very vulnerable time. There are lots of things on your mind. You do have worries. You worry about being a good parent. You know, there's no instruction manual when you come home. So you have lots of anxiety. You're worrying about finances. There's so much that you worry about. And so, you know, to use that particular time to kind of prey on vulnerabilities is particularly insidious. And then what they try to do is really just set you up with the idea that breastfeeding may not work, and that if it doesn't, you know, you have this product, and, you know, kind of hoping that it becomes that self-fulfilling prophecy. And we know that in other countries, this fear of insufficient milk doesn't exist as a problem. It is mostly a U.S. And a Western world problem. And so in cultures where breastfeeding naturally happens, it just happens, and women don't worry that it's not going to happen.
Do you know if their care providers are trained differently? You know, so say other countries that you were saying, the U.S., there's very little breastfeeding instruction for OBs and even pediatricians. So, and that can lead to women feeling not supported. Are other countries the education different?
Yeah, definitely the education is different, and then the cultural expectation is different. You know, that, and that, remember, you know, I'm a big believer that culture actually shapes norms. So in a culture where that is different, then the fact that women breastfeed happens and doctors don't feel the need to interfere, right? So not necessarily that they would have to learn more, but they certainly interfere less, right? Mm-hmm. So I remember I was blessed to be in the Food and Community Fellowship Program with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy for 2 years, and we traveled to Bolivia. And I remember I went to the doctor's office there to talk to him about breastfeeding, and I remember seeing this huge sign about breastfeeding, and it also included showing that breastfeeding can be used as a form of birth control, which is something we would never talk about here. So I was asking him, and you know, I'm a product of New York City public schools, but my Spanish is pretty good. I made it through AP, and I was asking him, like, what does he say when women have trouble breastfeeding? And he just could not understand my question. And so I asked our guide, our translator, to ask him, and she asked him 6 different ways. And, you know, he didn't understand the question, but he just didn't understand the question, right? It wasn't a language barrier, but to him, he was like, what do you mean women have trouble breastfeeding? You know? And so finally, in his answer, he said to us, eat quinoa. and if you go to Bolivia, eat quinoa is the answer for everything, right? No matter what you're going through, the answer is eat quinoa. And so,
right. That reminds me of that movie, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, where the answer to every issue is Windex. So,
Right. Exactly.
All right. I kind of like.
I mean, in certain cultures, they have their default answer, and in Bolivia, it was eat quinoa. And so, you know, for him, he didn't really understand. Like, what do you mean people having trouble breastfeeding? You know, sure, they may have. And maybe the baby didn't latch properly and you're actually dealing with a real latch problem or a tongue tie. But the problem about the woman's problem, you know, is not something that is culturally normal. I mean, when we were there, babies were just everywhere. Every place we went, mothers were with their children. And so the things that make breastfeeding happen naturally, we know in this country, women are going back to work 2 and 3 weeks after birth, which is unacceptable. Being separated from your child from an early age, we know, if you looked in the book, that maternity wards were created, that infant formula companies actually were given hospitals money to design their maternity wards. And in those designs, mother and baby were far away from each other, surprise, surprise, because they know that mothers need to be close to their babies. That helps lactation. That helps your milk come in. And so the way that they have insinuated themselves into the structure of how we birth is just phenomenal and just despicable at the same time.
Just a small question. I was kind of fascinated. You said the head of one of the companies had 75% of the women while pregnant. How did they get that information?
Exactly.
Is it from things like, I know so many people, I did this myself. Like, I signed up for babycenter.com so that every week I found out, okay, this week it's the size of a tomato, and next week it's the size of a kumquat.
And those emails don't stop until they're like going to college. You're like,
exactly.
I know how big my baby is. Thanks.
So by women doing that, which they think is, you know, pretty harmless, is that, are places like that, and I'm not naming necessarily Baby Center, but are places that people sign up unknowingly getting their information given away, you think?
Yeah, and it's not just that. It's like shopping rewards clubs, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I purchase wipes from just to keep in my car because of the children, and next thing you know, I got an infant formula thingy. So, you know, like the way that they, the way that marketing happens, sometimes it could be what you clicked on Facebook, and next thing you know, you see this ad pop up, you know? And so it's extremely insidious the way that they will look at anything and they will target you, because for them, the chance to get you is worth the cost of sending a free sample to the wrong person, you know? Mm-hmm. And so between our shopper rewards cards and all these things, which are kind of cueing our buying habits, right? Or you'll buy something like a wipe and you'll get a coupon for formula. You're like, right. I just, you know, so these are the ways that, you know, marketing has become so super segmented and so super precise that they are just looking for any clue to get you.
Yeah, that's a little surprising. Something else I found out very surprising was that formula is not FDA approved. I was shocked because I feel like, I guess it's not considered a drug. Can you explain that more?
Yeah, so in the book, I really kind of walk through the process, but formula is considered a food, not a drug, and that allows it to not reach certain levels of approvals and the same rigor as something that was a drug. And so really, it just has to meet the GRAS, generally regarded as safe protocol, which I explain, but basically that just means that infants are being used as, you know, as petri dishes, and they get to try something out. And then if there's any problem, then they will recall it or change it. And so it's a very dangerous system. And the fact that this is allowed on, you know, kind of unknowing infants is really, really dangerous. The other thing that I think is always important to know, particularly with new parents, is that infant formula contains dangerous sugars. You may know people of means who don't even buy U.S. formula because the dangerous sugar, sucrose, has been outlawed in other European countries because of its known connection to obesity. But that sugar component has not been banned from U.S. infant formula. And many people, particularly in New York City, of means, they get their formula from Europe because of these known sugars. And so we are not being told sugar content. In the book, I highlight some independent exams, some independent testing that had showed some sugar content as much as a Red Bull. And so it is very dangerous that, one, you know, if we're going to have formula in this country, we have a right to know what's in it. And it needs to be of a certain nutritional quality. And we don't even have that. It should be the best that there is. And it's not.
So there's not a standard set for infant formulas have to have this many vitamins or this much lack of sugar, or it's a little more open and wild.
Well, the infant formula companies have been allowed to kind of create their own standards. And of course, you know, they have, you know, there is a nutritional standard that really hasn't changed since the 1980s. But in terms of sugar content, they do not have to disclose.
Oh, I do. I mean, when you were mentioning that the U.S. has a different standard than European countries, I immediately thought, you know, if you can, but it does, I'm sure it's expensive to get, you know, infant formula from elsewhere. So it really, then it starts to go into a whole nother conversation of disparity of income.
That's why I said women of means who are able to do it. Yeah. It is expensive.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit. So my kids are 6 and 3, and even in that time, I think a huge achievement that has come upon is the fact that insurance companies are now covering breast pumps. But you were mentioning that there was opposition met along the way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, I mean, anytime you're talking about breastfeeding, there's always going to be some sort of political pushback and, you know, kind of getting into this divide around, you know, who is breastfeeding, who does not breastfeed. You know, I think that that's very, you know, it's very sad that people are having these obstacles, and we can put aside money for all sorts of things. But the idea of government supporting breastfeeding to some people was a bit too far. So, you know, just as the government creates other nutritional standards, we should consider support for breastfeeding to be a national priority. And so that's, you know, a little upsetting, to say the least, and really, you know, says a lot about where our priorities are as a country. You know, the other thing with the breast pumps, I mean, obviously we may lose this provision in current efforts to refill the Affordable Care Act. So it's really unfortunate. You know, I mean, many women have been trying to get them while they can, because we don't know the state of our healthcare system. But making sure that you actually know the process, the pump that you're getting is of a good quality so it can do the job. Also, you know, I've been really talking a lot about hand expression, because I feel that, you know, pumps are important, but they're another area where we've been told that we need a machine to finish the job. Mm-hmm. And so I've been talking to mothers about really learning about hand expression as well, because sometimes your hand can do what a pump cannot.
Like when you're stuck on a plane and you don't have your pump and you have to hand express, which exactly. I have done.
Absolutely.
You got to know what to do.
You got to know what to do. And, you know, again, for me, that idea that we need other things to feed our babies has been fed to us, you know. And, you know, there are times when your hands can actually do the trick, and perhaps even better than a pump by some experts. So, again, just rethinking and us reframing this idea that we don't always need medical interventions in birth.
So one thing that I like that you talked a lot about you talked a lot about the disparity in breastfeeding among different racial and socioeconomic groups. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's really troubling that in this country, for over 40 years, there's been a racial disparity in breastfeeding rates, particularly between Black women and white women. And when you look at kind of like the gold standard of infant nutrition, which is 12 months of exclusive breastfeeding, you know, the disparity is often as much as 50%. And so, you know, this whole question of who has the quote unquote privilege to breastfeed is not just one about money. It's also one about class and race, which, you know, may tie into socioeconomics, but, you know, really understanding the cultural barriers. I find that really interesting because Black women have had such a rich history of breastfeeding, particularly during slavery. Black women were stopped from breastfeeding their own children to breastfeed the children of their slave owners. And this was because they were known as good breastfeeders. You know, that's what something that was part of their culture, clearly coming from Africa, and was something they continued to do. But I think this disruption that occurred during slavery created a kind of a cultural stop, as it will, that now, especially when you talk to older women, you know, those grannies and those great aunties who are often very influential to mothers today, they still have this negative association around breastfeeding as something that, you know, we were forced to do, or something that Black women did because they had to, and it was, you know, things that remind them of a time that they prefer to not recall. And so really trying to understand the cultural nuances of breastfeeding, because we do see such different responses across cultures, is also a part of the picture, because we can't go around saying, you know, one message that doesn't work for a particular group of people and expecting them to respond. And so, you know, a lot of my work has been trying to understand what is the language, what is the communication, how do we better communicate to make sure we resolve this issue.
I like that, but it is important because not everyone's going to hear things the same way. Do you have any thoughts of how to reach each different group and how to support them?
Well, I think one of the things, and you may know, I'm one of the co-founders of Black Breastfeeding Week, and one of the things that we specifically do there is really focus on empowerment. Like, you know, I think there's been a lot of doom and gloom around Black women, both with their birth outcomes, which are statistically poor, across the board, and also with the breastfeeding rates. And so we really try to empower women, not to make them into a sad story or a sob story. And so by really, you know, inviting them to reclaim something that's powerful and empowering and part of how we redefine ourselves, we've had a lot of success and a lot of momentum around creating spaces on social media, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that part has also been key. The fact that we have other ways to connect and to see other women doing these things has been really, really key for helping other cultures who may have a taboo or may have been disconnected to say, oh, wait, people who look like me do this. And I want to be a part of that and, you know, and not just look like me in terms of, you know, ethnicity or skin tone, but also maybe in life circumstance or income or employment field, you know. So, again, the more we can... excuse me, create more variation and more variability in the experiences, the more we're going to get folks in.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So you were also talking about what I've noticed in places like New York City. You know, there's a ton of places to turn to. If you need breastfeeding support, there's La Leche League. There's a ton of support. But that is not available for everyone. In fact, I like that you made kind of a similar idea of food deserts. There are places that women just don't have support available. You know, there's mm-hmm. not. How would you suggest they find some support or resources?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, that in itself is the problem, right? So one, we understand that this is so important. When I did the food desert work, the first food desert work, is understanding that for breastfeeding has been a very, it's on you conversation, right? It's up to you to find that support, find that group, find that whatever. And we haven't looked at the fact that actually people may be struggling to do that. Even the way that we now understand food access, right? That some people, it's great to tell them to eat well and exercise, but it may be really hard to get healthy fruits and vegetables where they live, and nobody bothered to see if there was a safe place to exercise. So it's a message that's disconnected from the reality of many people's lives. And so that's what I'm afraid has been happening with breastfeeding. We've been telling women to do something, leaving them on their own to figure it out and not checking in whether they could actually access the support that they need. So to your point, yes, in New York City, you know, there are lots of places to go. But, you know, I've worked in Birmingham, Alabama, New Orleans, throughout the Southeast. I run projects in Detroit and Philadelphia. And, you know, it is not the same. There are certain places La Leche League does not go. And I've said that to La Leche League. So we need to do better about creating support all places, because it perpetuates the stereotype about who breastfeeds and who gets the support to breastfeed, and then who's left holding the bag to do it on their own without any support. And so one of the things is that we have to make sure that when we think about areas that may be more challenging, how do we create support that is there, that is local, that is easily accessible, right? I'm always saying we want for our food what we should want for the first food support, right? Just like you don't want to have to go 10 miles to get a banana, nobody should have to travel great distances to get support for the first food. And so, again, how do we create a model that's built on equitable access for everybody, not based on you living in a privileged city or you living in a high-income neighborhood, but based on the fact that you're a woman who has a basic right to feed. And so everything you need to exercise that right needs to be easily available to you. I'm also encouraged by the role of social media. If people aren't finding support locally, physically on the ground, there are many places they can go to. There are Facebook groups. People are now using their iPhones to offer lactation support. So, you know, thankfully through social media and technology, we're looking for ways to get into that. But motherhood is isolating enough. And I think that ultimately people need some community where they live. And so we are countering that. I just, a few weeks ago, opened the first community. We call it the Lactation Lounge and Mother's Hub in Detroit. So it's a place where mothers can go to breastfeed or pump, but it's also a place for empowerment. It's a place we're going to have lessons, pop-up classes, and different things to support mothers in their lives. And so, again, creating these things within the community are really, really important.
Yes, absolutely. Every mother deserves the right to breastfeed her child if she wants to. It should not mm-hmm. be one of privilege. It should be a woman's right if she wants that. So you mentioned social media. I want to jump into that a little, because I thought you had some really interesting points in your book. That what do you think the power of celebrity has on breastfeeding?
Well, I think the power of celebrity is often a double-edged sword. I certainly feel that there are two things. One, for white women, it has certainly made breastfeeding a cachet, right? We have lots of white female celebrities who breastfeed their children, Gwen Stefani, Jennifer Garner, you name it, the list goes on. And so that has helped elevate breastfeeding, which we hope benefits us all. Black women have not had the same kind of what I call the parade of celebrities. You know, we have Beyonce, and we're very excited, and hopefully she'll say something about the twins soon. And, you know, but again, that same kind of women after woman after woman after woman after woman, we haven't had that. And so we're, you know, that has been part of another reason, you know, that has led to this divide and this perception about who breastfeeds and who doesn't. I mean, second with the celebrity thing can come the idea that, well, of course she can breastfeed. She doesn't have to go back to work in 2 weeks, and she's got a nanny to help her and somebody to cook and somebody to clean. And so sometimes we can look at celebrities as being disconnected from our lives. And so, you know, and so it becomes the only if, like, sure, I would breastfeed too, if only if I had a trainer and a cook and someone to clean up for me, but I don't, so I can't. So again, you know, sometimes celebrities can be a double-edged sword, but I do think that the more that we can make it normal among women that we, you know, admire and look at, whether we admit it or not, the more, the better it can be for all of us.
Yeah, there was a point in The Business of Being Born, I'm sure you've heard of that documentary, where they talk about, you know, if certain celebrities really talked about home birth or natural birth, then more women would go into that direction. But celebrities do have a pretty powerful influence over trends and what we do with our bodies. And speaking of what we do with our bodies, yeah, you also made an interesting point about the over-sexualized message of breasts and impact of public breastfeeding. I remember breastfeeding often in public because, you know, I was out and about and I would get looks, you know, and I wasn't too keen on always covering up my child. You know, my nipple wasn't showing, but I wasn't ashamed of it. But I do feel there is a lot of side looks over what is she doing in public breastfeeding?
Yeah, it's a big challenge. I mean, obviously in this country, breasts are viewed as a sexual tool, and they're really, they belong to the advertising industry, right? Breasts are used to sell chicken wings and beer all the time and burgers. But if a woman is breastfeeding, then people are uncomfortable, you know? And so we have to, again, as women, kind of take back our bodies and say, it's not for you to tell me what are acceptable uses of my breasts and what are unacceptable. That's basically what happened. We've been told and sold messages about what is an acceptable use of our breasts and what uses will not be culturally accepted. And that is a narrative that we have to reclaim to kind of say, yeah, no, we're not doing that. And it's also, sometimes, unfortunately, you may hear from women that other women have been the ones kind of throwing the side eye the hardest. And that's unfortunate and something we have to do as women work to kind of, you know, say, listen, my breast is of no threat to you. I'm just here feeding my kid.
They're not going to come attack you.
Right. You know, and also they're not going to make your man look at me instead of you. You know what I'm saying? Like that is what's happening. That is the fear. And, you know, women in some very honest moments in the focus groups I've been involved with have said, you know, if you potentially expose what is viewed as a sexual tool in front of, you know, my man, then you may get his interest, and that's a threat to me. And that's a very dangerous way of thinking and a little scary.
Mm-hmm. We got to support one another a little more. So as we start to wrap up, do you have any final words you want to share with people, as well as telling people where to find you and what you're up to?
Yeah, I mean, I just really want everyone to kind of get involved with this conversation. We have to take this burden of breastfeeding and birth like off the shoulders of women and start to look up at the structural barriers. We have to start demanding for a paid maternity leave. It is completely unacceptable that we are the only industrialized nation that does not have one. We have to demand that our physicians and our pediatricians have been trained properly. Certainly, I know that is important to ask about office hours and well visit rooms and sick baby rooms, but we should be holding our pediatricians accountable for their breastfeeding knowledge. Ask them where they were taught, what do they know, and if they don't have an answer that sounds like it came from the Academy of Breastfeeding Medicine, then we should let them know that's a problem, right? We have to use our power as consumers to start shifting the responsibility, not for ourselves to figure it out and to scramble and to race down highways to get support, but for our physicians to be properly trained in infant nutrition based on our biological norm. So that's one thing I would love for all of your listeners and folks who come through your center to think about how we can use our power as women to start holding these physicians accountable. So they're saying, you know what, moms keep asking me where I got my breastfeeding education, so maybe I need to fix up in that area. And so mostly that we can just create a conversation that's not about us, but it's about us having the policies and structures and the culture in place to support whatever choice that we choose, right? Whether you choose to formula feed or breastfeed or do both or everything in between, there should be supports and policies in place to make that happen, and that we could actually value mothering as important work. That's really my goal.
And take some of the stress away from it, too.
Yeah, and take the stress away, and people don't have to feel so bad. And then, you know, in terms of keeping up with me, which I would love folks to do, I would encourage people to please sign up for my newsletter. I do write often, and I like to share ideas about this issue and what we're talking about motherhood. You can sign up at my website, KimberlySealsAllers.com. Please follow me on Twitter at IMKSealsAllers, and also on Facebook, my professional Facebook page at IMKSealsAllers. Also, always have great updates about where I'm going. Lots of great events coming up, lots of travel with book events in different cities. So I would love to stay connected.
Absolutely. So we'll put all that on our show notes so people can read a little bit about what we've talked about and then find you. Well, I wanted to thank you so much for your time. I know you're in a book tour, busy, you're a busy mama, you're a busy author, busy working lady.
Oh, busy. So, yeah, isn't it crazy?
It really is. So thank you so much for your time, and we'll see each other through the internet at some point. We'll have a wonderful...
Sounds good.
All right, have a great day. Take care.
Thank you. You too.
Bye.
This has been an episode of Yoga Birth Babies, produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. You can catch us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Periscope. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Thanks for listening.